Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and really happy to have back vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward. Jim is the service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. He's had master certification for many years. Joins us every other month to help you out with your vehicle questions. And certainly if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. Problems with your vehicle? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Jim Ward, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be here with you.
Well, good to have you here. Let's talk about tires first. What kind are best for winter driving?
Well, it depends on your driving circumstances. Most people can get by with all-season, tires, all-season radial tires, depending on tread depth. As tires get worn down, our outlook in Wisconsin is different when we look at tires in May than when we look at them in October. A tire that's at 5/32 of an inch of tread depth, they start out at about 9 or 10 on cars and maybe up to 12 on a truck. Tires that are at 5/32 in May, you may go down to 3/32 and still get reasonable performance out of them. But going into in October, going into winter, we're more concerned with ice and snow. In any season, though, that tread depth is going to affect you on wet roads. The stopping distance is quite a bit different. No matter what the season in May or the middle of summer, in rainy weather when the roads are wet, they've done several tests with this with a professional driver driving 60 miles an hour and braking as quickly as they reasonably can. And the stopping distance when you're down to 3 to 5/32 is several car lengths, up to 8, 9, 10 car lengths longer than if you have new tires. So in as much as it would be great if we all could have, long following distances and plenty of room to stop, that isn't the reality on most of our roads. So you really want to think about tires if they're getting down in that range of 3 to 5 and you're going to have to drive in busy traffic on wet roads.
Yeah, for sure. Are the tires one manufacturer about the same as another? I imagine there's a relationship between quality and price to some extent.
There certainly is. And some of the most expensive tires, they are better tires. Sometimes, I'm not sure they're that much better. When you look at tires, one of the things, several things that you want to look at and think about are road hazard coverage. A lot of times when you buy a tire, the store or shop you buy them from will just include road hazard tire coverage. Sometimes you have to pay a little bit more for that, but that's like insurance for your tires. If you hit a pothole, pick up a nail, then that's a coverage that you'd have for a period of time that would either replace or repair that tire if it's repairable, in the event of some kind of road hazard. Now, road hazard isn't the same as a defect. A defect has got one type of coverage, but if you actually hit a pothole and damage a tire or pick up a nail, that's where that road hazard coverage comes in. So that's, no matter what tire you're looking at, that's something fairly important that you want to think about, and it's a good idea to either purchase or to look for a place where that's included with the tires. Another thing that you want to look at is that tires are rated for tread wear. So not every tire manufacturer and not every type of tire will offer a tread wear warranty, but most do. And so, that means that if you buy a tire that's got a 60,000 mile or 70,000 mile tread wear warranty and you only get 35,000 miles out of it, you can go back and that tire manufacturer will make an adjustment and prorate a rating for you. And it's important to understand that if you go to seek that kind of coverage, one of the first things they're going to ask is to see the records that the tires were rotated and that the alignment was correct when at the time the tires were put on. So those are some important things to follow to ensure that your tire warranties are in fact good. Otherwise, winter tires, snow tires, dedicated snow tires,
yeah,
are really different than conventional all-season tires. It's a different type of rubber. There's a lot of tires that call themselves mud and snow and different things, but a snow tire has got a special little imprint on the side of the tire, a little triangle with a snowflake on it, and that type of rubber, it behaves differently in cold temperatures. That type of tire's tread is cut differently to get more of the snow and water out from that tire. And the other reality of those tires is that they really are not something that you want to leave on all year at all, because typically once the weather is consistently above 50 degrees, those tires start to wear very, very quickly. So they're a winter tire for specific temperature ranges. And if you're someone who lives out in the country and you have to drive, you know, those kind of routes that don't necessarily get plowed as early, that's the individual that wants to think about a dedicated snow tire. If you live in town, you don't have to travel early before the plows are out, then you're, if you've got a good tread depth on, you know, conventional all-season tires, you're probably fine with that.
You know, this is a time of the year I start thinking about tire pressure because I almost always wind up with some low tire pressure during the winter months anyway. Why does that low pressure come on so greatly during colder times?
Well, it's the when it's colder out, there are a number of different ways. Air is always escaping from tires at a very, very low rate. And ultimately, though, when it's cold, it can escape either around the bead of the tire, typically at a higher rate than it normally does. And it's something that we consistently see when the temperature drops. It doesn't even have to be wintertime. Anytime we get about a 10, 15, or certainly 15 to 20 degree temperature drop, we will have a parade of cars in our drive-through in the morning because we will air up tires for anybody without an appointment. And ultimately, it's kind of hard to find air in a lot of places anymore. So when those lights come up, it's just directly related. It's similar to the reason that nitrogen, there's a lot of claims made for putting nitrogen in tires. A lot of them, I think there's such marginal advantage that it really doesn't make a lot of difference. They talk about it, you know, making the tire last longer and preventing, you know, moisture inside. But the main thing we see a difference of is that people who do put nitrogen in tend to have much less of that cold temperature drop air loss. They're not the ones in line waiting to get their tires aired up on those mornings that we get that parade of tire light cars.
Eugene in Viola has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Eugene.
Oh, hello, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a 97 Ford Ranger, and the speedometer tells me how fast I'm going, but it isn't kicking over the miles. Now, is there any simple way to fix that without replacing the whole speedometer head?
Well, once upon a time, I don't know that there are speedometer shops around anymore. To do repairs on speedometers, you have to be a certified speedometer shop. It's got to be a specialized shop. And so many speedometers are digital anymore that those places, I couldn't tell you where one exists, although one you probably search for it. But, you know, there's gearing inside the speedometer. There's one cable that comes up from the drive, either on the transmission or on the axle, that runs that speedometer, both the speed and the odometer part of it. So something inside of there has come apart or a gear is worn or something. And, you know, definitely once upon a time it was possible to have those repaired, but that might be a challenge now. It may come down to replacing the speedometer, but I would certainly search for it. There used to be several places in Madison that did that kind of repair. There may still be some around, but I haven't heard of one or seen one in a few years.
All right. There you go, Eugene. Thank you so much. Richard in Sparta, your turn now. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just bought a Toyota Prius, an all-wheel drive Toyota Prius. It's got about 7,000 miles on it. And I had a set of tires for my Toyota Corolla, Vex tires. They probably have about 1 year, maybe 2 years on them. And they fit, the wheels fit the Prius. Is there any reason to put those tires on my Prius, or actually any reason not to?
The reason, well, what you want to take a look at is the load rating of the tires. Priuses typically take a special tire because of the extra weight of the hybrid battery. The tires are rated at a higher load, and so that usually is the difference, that the Priuses and hybrids typically do take a different tire. So the load rating is something that is on some of the data that's on the sidewall. So if you take a look at that and look at the Corolla tires and Prius tires, and also that rating, I believe, is on the placard on the driver's door. It will be in the owner's manual as well to tell you what the load rating for any given year and model hybrid should be. And so you want to make sure those Corolla tires are at least that load rating.
All right. There you go, Richard. Thanks so much for calling. Richard mentioned Prius, and my daughter's Prius, she's just 17 and hadn't had her license, but she hadn't driven much. And the Prius that I got for her, it's got about 140,000 miles on it. She informed me that the brakes were squeaking or something was squeaking. So we took it in and the front brake rotors were rusted. And we wound up putting on front brake pads and rotors at your shop to kind of fix the issue. But that car sitting around, you know, they can rust.
So many folks are driving so much less than they used to. A lot more people are working from home, and the car sits a lot. And, you know, I really highly recommend in those situations that you take that car out for a good 20-mile drive at least once a week and get it up to highway speed. And, you know, I don't want to recommend that you lock up your brakes or brake that hard, but you want to create some friction and grind off that oxidation. The only thing that keeps rust from forming on those rotors is driving and braking. The other thing that we've seen this summer at an unprecedented rate was replacement of 12-volt batteries. Similarly, the cars aren't getting driven. They sit there, and that's just not the friend of the battery and not the friend of anything that normally is a moving part that's exposed, like brake rotors that can rust. So, yeah, if you're in this situation where suddenly you're not driving the car every day and not commuting to work, get that thing out once a week and take it for a good 20, at least a 20-mile drive, and get on the highway where at highway speed you can brake a little harder a few times, get that oxidation kind of ground off of there, and hopefully avoid having to do those kind of repairs and replace batteries prematurely. And there's certainly things that we're seeing with the new reality of people's working and not driving situations.
Yeah, I had to replace my own battery, and I wasn't at home. I was in Watertown, so I tried to start the car up after being there, and the battery was dead, and so got a jump and got to the Farm and Fleet and got myself a new battery. But that battery had been in the car. I think it was the original battery, and it's the car's like, what, 8 years old or something. So it didn't owe me anything.
Well above average age, and you know the average age across the country is about 5 years. But the hotter the climate, the quicker batteries go, 2 to 3 years down in the southern lower, you know, third of the country, and a little better here. But then, you know, so much has changed with the people not driving that now affects them too. But it's certainly not convenient. So although, you know, there are tests for batteries that have some predictive ability, one of the things we're finding is with this particular situation, people not driving, that test may very well say the battery's good today and got good life, but it doesn't mean that it's not going to fail next week. And anything over five, I've seen conventional batteries, 12-volt batteries in a car last as long as 11 years, which is really on the outside, you know, the far end of the bell-shaped curve. And, you know, sometimes they only last a couple of years, but really when you get to be about 5 years old on a battery, you know, it is starting to potentially get on borrowed time. And although you want to get what you can out of it and don't want to replace it prematurely, on the other hand, you don't want to end up stranded somewhere.
Well, let's go to Steele in Racine now. Steele, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Yes. Come wintertime and you always have to watch the tire pressure, and you go to different places to get the tire filled up, and then you have to take your gloves off and you know, maybe 20% of the time they don't work, then you're driving around searching. What about, I have a garage and an electric tire compressor that I have a Prius too, so it has to go up to like 36 pounds, and something that that you may recommend, or if you got an air tank and you kept it in your house warm, would a reasonable, modest tank fill up four tires, and you could just take it somewhere and fill up just the tank?
Well, you can do that. There are tanks that don't even just like a compressor has, like an air compressor have. You can buy a tank that without the compressor that you can go anywhere that you normally fill your tires and fill the tank. But they do leak down. You know, it over time, it's you know, in the course of a month, that tank is probably going to be empty. So it is something that you need to keep an eye on. That almost like you need to keep an eye on your tires. There are little electric air compressors that they are. Some of them will run right off of 12 volts, like in a power socket in the car, like what we used to call a lighter jack, but power socket. Some of those also will plug into 110 volt at home. Those are slow to fill a tire. They take longer, but they do work. And that's something you can actually just keep in the trunk of the car. So, you know, you potentially could do it yourself, just plugging it into the lighter or the power jack. So, those are all good options. One other thing about tires, when you're going to air up your tires, there's a placard on the door jamb of the driver's door that says what size tires you should have and what the pressure should be. All manufacturers will have charts for their shops that recommend that if the temperature, it's a chart that as the temperature drops, they recommend a certain increase in tire pressure, and it's rarely more than a couple of pounds, 2 to 3, maybe 5 pounds at max. If the temperature is predicted, over the next several weeks or months to be extremely cold, so that's something to keep in mind. If we're looking at cold weather and your tire pressure rating is 35, it's perfectly fine to set that at 37 or 38. As the temperature warms up, you want to correct that pressure again, but it does help with the cold loss that tends to inevitably happen.
Yeah, there you go, Steele. Thank you so much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, he's service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him with us. And Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance, maybe some winter preparation tips from our guest today, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him along. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Jeff in West Salem, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jeff.
Well, good morning. I've got a 2005 Ford Ranger, and about a year ago, I pulled into a parking lot and went in somewhere for a little while. And I come back out, and the truck wouldn't start. Well, then yesterday, I pulled into the parking lot at the hardware store and pulled in, and it wouldn't start. It turns over. I'm thinking it was flooded, but a year apart, what could be going on that would be a year apart? It's probably to the day.
Well, there's certainly something electrical most likely going on, and in vehicles and automobiles and trucks, electrical problems are notoriously intermittent. But half the time that we have something going on, it starts out as intermittent at least, and it'll just do it occasionally, and of course eventually it's gonna get where it does it all the time. I mean, you may have a crankshaft sensor that's not sending a signal, and that is a component that's kind of notorious for working intermittently, and just every now and then at first it may act up. The while it's acting up, you're running a couple of tests to find out if you have spark or not is, to try to just eliminate one system or the other. If a car is cranking over but not starting, it's either not getting spark or it's not getting fuel or not making compression. And certainly spark and fuel are the most likely, and it almost always comes down to ignition more than fuel. Running some tests at that point. Ultimately, it eventually did get it started. You just kept trying?
Well, yeah, I let it set for a half an hour and then came out, and it started right up, just like as usual.
And when it started
like
right
an
up,
old,
it, an old, it didn't yeah, run
an old
rough. It didn't
problem. It seemed.
It didn't idle rough or run rough, though, when it started?
Nope, not at all.
So often if an engine floods, once it does start, then you may have a little rough running for a little bit. And so if it didn't act like that, it almost sounds like it's not getting fuel. But, some tests need to be run. You need to catch it red-handed. Some tests need to be run when it's acting up. There's just nothing more frustrating than that, Jeff. I realize that, when it's just going to be once a year and you only have a little bit of time to try to test it. But that half-hour period, that is when any tests need to be run to try to catch it, because anything you try to test once it's starting and running normally is, someone could do a visual check, might get lucky and see something, but more than likely it's going to have to be, a test that's not just going to be a visual inspection. It's going to be a voltage check to see if you're getting spark or fuel, and that's unfortunately the reality of an intermittent problem like that.
Well, you're going to have to note that date on the calendar, Jeff, and where you're going. Don't go too far on that date next year. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. Bill in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My wife has an Elantra. One of the vehicles we have is an Elantra. And we got a safety recall on the, I think they called it the tire maintenance kit. It's an inflation kit and sealer, caster a sealant in place of the spare tire. In hindsight, I'm thinking, how many of the manufacturers are going that route and eliminating the spare, you know, percentage-wise nowadays?
Well, Toyota certainly has a couple of models like that. When they had the plug-in Prius debuted, it did not have a spare tire and it had that little kit in it. It's not a high percentage of cars. Most vehicles still do have spares, and some of them that don't have spare tires don't have that kit either. They have, you know, some of them have run flat tires that basically, even though a tire may get punctured and not have air pressure, you could drive a limited speed, usually like up to 50 miles an hour for a limited distance. It usually is like 10 to 20 miles, something like that. But that kit, you know, those are something that really are a last resort if there's anything else you can do, because it's part of what the kit involves is spraying a stop leak inside the tire, and one of the first things that does is almost always ruins the air valve, which is also your tire pressure sensor that you're filling the tire with. When that goop goes in, it may seal the hole in the tire, but it will probably also ruin that the air valve and tire pressure sensor. So it's a fairly small percentage of cars, but as they try to make cars lighter and make room for other systems, that's one of the things that we see go. Fortunately, I'm not a big fan of it, you probably tell, I'm grateful that at least at this point it's a very small percentage of vehicles that have it.
Bill, thank you much for calling. Well, Russ in Pleasant Springs, we're on to you now. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about my 2013 Ford Edge, which is not much bigger, I don't think, than a smart car. I bought it just this past March, so I haven't had it a year to see how it handles all the seasons. But in April, I was in the middle of quite a rain downpour, and I have a slanted gravel driveway. And as I tried to get it up the driveway, it started spinning the front wheels, and I really had to get on it, and then it left ruts. And I'm thinking, wow, this is just wet gravel, what it's going to be like when I have snow. So I'm wondering, would putting snow tires on just the front drive wheels eliminate my traction problem in the coming months?
It would help, but it's not recommended to do that. When you don't have the same tire tread and the same type of tires front and rear, you run risk of handling issues. It, you know, the what we call the ABCs of tires: acceleration, braking, and cornering. Your acceleration is going to be improved, but when you're braking, in particular if it's just on wet roads, you can kind of be compromised to have that kind of tread in front and not in the back. And particularly in cornering, you can have compromised handling from not having the same tires. But certainly traction would be improved and help avoid situations like that, both with gravel and snow, you know, and it's hindsight usually after you've been in an experience like that, but having some momentum and having a little speed to get through, you know, a soft spot in gravel or in snow, particularly if you're on an incline going up a hill, are often part of the key to that too. But yep, no doubt that would help.
Russ, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Eileen in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a 2010 Honda Fit that I bought used a few months ago. And this summer, I was coming out of a driveway onto a pretty busy road, and the front axle snapped. It was really, really scary. And, of course, it's been replaced. But I'm wondering, what are the chances of that happening again?
Not really likely. That is not a typical or a really common breakdown on most cars, although, you know, it is something that for some reason, we don't work on Hondas here at our shop, but we do work on the used cars that we take in, and it is something I've heard of happening on that car. I don't know of any recall on that, but it's even on the Honda Fit, it's not a common repair, but that is what I would recommend is going on to a Honda website, putting your VIN number in there, and just checking for recalls. I'm not positive there's a recall on that model, but I know it's happened on a few Honda Fits that I'm aware of, and I don't, certainly not a Honda thing, but I think just that model has had a little bit of an issue with that. So not a common breakdown or failure, but, you know, in a situation like that, it sure is scary, and you don't want to be in that situation again. So, yeah, go to Honda.com and put your VIN number in and do a recall check and just see if there are either recalls or a support program for that axle concern.
All right. Good luck, Eileen. Thank you. Chuck in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate it.
Question I have for you, a 2015 Nissan Altima. A couple of weeks ago, I had brake pads put in it. The rotors and stuff look good, so they were not resurfaced. And now when I drive the car, everything brakes fine and stuff. But when I want to back up and reverse, it's like a screeching noise. And it's just in reverse. And when I just put the brakes on real lately, is it possible them pads could have been put in backwards?
Well, it is possible something might have been put together wrong. I don't know that the pads would be put in backwards, but there's hardware clips that help hold the pads in the right position and anti-vibration clips. So if some of those clips are not positioned correctly, that can do it. When brake pads are replaced, most manufacturers have a special type of grease that obviously doesn't go on the braking surface. It goes on the backside of the brake pad, and typically there's a specific amount, very little, in a couple of specific places. If that isn't done right, you can get brake squeal after the brake job. And typically, you know, rotors, we usually do something to them. Rotors have to seat into the brake pad has to seat into the rotor, and most often we resurface rotors and try to take a minimal amount off, but at least to provide a new braking surface. And ultimately, when we do that, the pads are sensitive to any kind of contamination. So whether we're putting new rotors on or resurfacing rotors, we tend to wash those with soap and water, literally just Dawn and water, and clean those off, because sometimes you can have a coating that will cause noise too with the new pads. But I would certainly recommend taking it back to where you got it. If it's something that you're just hearing first thing in the morning, I mean, sometimes some brake squeak is normal. So you can get a flash oxidation overnight. And typically, if that's what it is, just hitting the brakes real hard, if the noise stops and doesn't do it anymore, it may just be the humidity and that oxidation. But, you know, I would take it back and have them take a look. But again, if it does do it just first thing in the morning, you're going to want to leave it there the night before so they can actually duplicate it and hear and see what's going on. And then, you know, of course, double check their work and make sure all the clips and things are in the right positions.
All right. Good luck, Chuck. Thank you. Ed in West Chicago, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. I have a 2005 Camry XLE and 150,000 miles, and it has kind of an odd electrical problem, whereas if we leave the lights on for very long or the radio, the battery wears down and goes dead. So we actually sometimes, you know, if you leave the trunk open for too long, it even goes down.
Does it happen when you're driving the car too?
Just when it sits. You know, the engine's off. And we've talked to our mechanic about it, and he said, you know, electrical problems are really hard to figure out. And I just replaced the battery because as the other one got older, we had to actually, turn the lights off because just waiting for the car to do it by itself, or if you left the doors open and it took too long, the thing would die.
Sure.
Any ideas?
Well, you know, just to say, and of course you know this, but if the engine's off, the lights or other devices will run the battery down, but it sounds like this is something that is quite accelerated from what you've ever experienced before, so there's something going on there. Now, it's possible that a new battery may have an issue, and so it's not that difficult to do a battery test, to have a battery tested somewhere, so that's one of the first easiest things to eliminate. If that battery itself is good, then what we want to do is take a look at the basic connections where the battery cables connect to the battery. Sometimes those get worn and they, you know, they won't tighten up properly, so you want to make sure that they are good and tight. Corrosion on those is another thing. Most often when a battery is replaced, they'll do a good job of taking a brush and some baking soda, a compound that'll clean the corrosion and acidity off of those battery cable connections to the battery itself. So that should be checked. And if all of that looks good, then we probably have a bad ground somewhere. There's the ground strap on the battery usually goes down and attaches to the frame. It's possible that where it attaches to the frame, that some oxidation has occurred, kind of rust, and it's not making a good contact there, which would keep the battery from charging up as it should. Typically, you know, the charging system, if that's got a problem, if the alternator is really not charging the battery well, typically you're going to have a warning light on. But if it's just right down to the bottom threshold of just passing that, that also is going to leave your battery in a state of, you know, all, barely enough charge normally to do things and not able to handle a load of having lights or a radio or something on. So there's a test that can be done on the alternator as well. But those, you know, within that range of things is where the problem is going to be found. Either we've got a new battery that's bad, we've got a bad connection somewhere, or we've got an alternator that's just marginally charging.
Ed, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Michael emailed, he has a 2017 Tacoma SR5 4x4, and the automatic transmission started to shift hard into the next gear. The next day, the transmission automatically started in fourth gear instead of first. He got a track-off error and an engine trouble light. Can he drive it to the shop if he uses the manual shift option and treat it like he's driving a stick with no clutch? Turn the engine off in neutral before shifting into park, and then he's wondering how long it would take to fix something like this.
Well, I would not recommend trying to drive it like a manual like that. The transmission's an electronically controlled transmission. You know, if you don't, you know, a low fluid level could cause this, but if you, it doesn't consume the fluid. So if you didn't see puddles under it, there's no reason to think that, that the fluid level should be low. And more likely, there's an electronic solenoid that's ticking or not working right. And there are some solenoids, pressure solenoids in a transmission, where if they're malfunctioning and you operate that transmission, you can do damage to it pretty quickly. So unfortunately, in a situation like this, it's not a good idea to drive it. There are a few repairs that can be done to automatic transmissions. You know, we used to rebuild them, but you know, there's hardly a shop anywhere anymore that actually rebuilds them. But that kind of electronic solenoid failure, the solenoids can be replaced independently of replacing the transmission. The valve body, the lower part of the transmission with the fluid routing control also can be replaced. But I'm going to bet that this is a solenoid problem and ultimately can be repaired. It's probably going to take a couple of days because, you know, it's not a common repair and it's not a part that most places probably are going to have in stock. I don't think we would have that in stock. That's all for that, but that's probably what's going on. But don't drive it because you could take what could be a fairly minor repair and become a transmission replacement.
No, John in Gays Mill emailed that he blew the timing belt on his 2004 Subaru and paid to have it fixed. Unfortunately, as part of the breakdown, he now has low compression in one of his cylinders. The idle's a little clunky, but otherwise runs okay. Is it bad to drive the car long-term with low compression in a cylinder?
Well, the repair, unfortunately, is a very expensive repair. Probably going to have to do a valve job. It's possible that one of the valves got bent. And ultimately, over time, with a cylinder that's not firing properly and not making compression, you're going to end up with carbon buildup, you know, inside the motor that becomes a progressive problem as well. So while it's drivable right now, this is something that is likely to slowly over time get worse. And you know, but it varies. I mean, you know, someone could drive something like that for a couple of years before something would break down. But some, you know, timing belt replacement is really important. There are some engines that are called non-interference and other engines that are called interference. And the difference is simply that, you know, if the timing belt breaks and the engine freeze spins on one type of engine, the interference engine, the pistons and valves can hit each other. And on other types of engines with a different design, they don't hit each other. They have clearance. And it just, you know, the engines are designed different ways for different reasons, for power and economy and different things. But yeah, you know, in a way you're almost lucky because often when that happens, the engine's toast and you're not even going to be able to drive it with low compression. But yeah, this is likely to progressively cause some other problems.
Kenneth in West Allis, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 98 Chevy Cavalier. I got a new battery for the car about a month ago. Now I'm having problems with the computer. Some of the lights that come on are the seatbelt light, the airbag light, the theft light, and I was wondering what I should do about that.
So after the car starts, these warning lights stay on?
Yes.
Okay, and they don't shut off at all. They just stay on the whole time the car is running consistently.
Some of them stay on all the time. Seatbelt light, airbag light, stay on all the time. And sometimes the theft light comes on, and then sometimes it goes out.
Well, those lights being on are going to be associated with some kind of a fault code that is going to be stored in the computer for the airbag system, the supplemental restraint system. And those codes are going to be a hint to what the problem is. You know, I've seen different scenarios play out. From the way you described it, it seems like this started happening right after a battery replacement. So sometimes what we see happen is because the previous battery failed, at some point the car may have been jump-started. And if sometimes when a car is jump-started, especially if the jumper cables aren't handled just right, it can cause a spark, which can cause a fuse to blow. So if a fuse was blown, I would expect you to have more consistent behavior with the other light. So I don't necessarily think a fuse is blown, but someone does need to read the codes. You know, most shops are going to need to do more than just read the codes, but the code will give you an idea that the airbag light code will give you some idea of where this problem is at. It may not even be related to the battery replacement, but it'd be quite a coincidence if it just started occurring after that. But that really is going to be the first step, is read those codes, find out what the problem areas potentially are from that code, and start looking there.
Yeah, there you go, Kenneth. Thank you. Patricia in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning, Larry and guest. My four tires were all purchased at the same time, and one of the tires invariably loses air pressure, maybe 2 or 3 pounds a week. Of course, in winter, it's even worse when all the tires start losing. Anyway, anytime I've had the tires rotated, I've had them reseal that tire rim, and it still occurs. So I don't know if your guest has a suggestion on what I should look out for.
Well, if they're resealing the rim, theoretically we've taken care of the possibility of the air leaking out between the tire and the rim. But the other place that it can leak out is at the valve stem, the air valve that you're putting there. And essentially, tires, the diagnosis of tires is about as primitive as it's ever been since they first put air in tires, and that is that we tend to put them underwater. A technician will look for a leak with a little spritzer with soap and water in it, and the soapy, bubbly water often will help find a leak. But if that doesn't show anything, then the next thing we do is we literally have a dunk tank for tires. That's the shape of a tire, and a little bigger and wider and deeper, so that you can submerge about half the tire at a time, and you put that tire underwater and watch for air bubbles. So, I have from time to time even seen a rim. I've seen steel rims rust out, and if this is an alloy rim, I've seen alloy rims develop kind of a porosity. That's really uncommon. So if they've sealed that tire and you've had that done more than once, I really think we probably have an air valve here that's leaking.
Ah, all right. Patricia, thank you, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him back to answer your vehicle questions. We've zeroed in a little on winter preparation, but we're taking a whole variety of questions today, as we pretty much always do whenever Jim's with us. You can join in. I think there's an open line at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Nick.
I just needed an opinion. I got gifted to me a 2011 Matrix. I love that car. It only drives 2 miles to work and 2 miles back, so it's awesome, I guess. But the problem is the transmission is losing. Is it better to place a transmission or just get a different vehicle?
And Nick, at least from my end here, I had a cutout when you started to say something about the transmission. If you could repeat, what is the transmission doing?
Oh, I'm sorry. The transmission's working fine. It's just that there's a seal or something leaking, and the car does have almost 300,000 miles on there. I was just wondering if it's worth it to replace that or just get a new vehicle. Like I said, I only drive it 4 miles back and forth to work, so...
Has someone looked at it and diagnosed what's leaking and what they're recommending would be done to repair it?
My father, he's a mechanic, and he said that there's a seal, like the transmission seal cover, is that he said it was leaking.
Okay, well, it could be the oil pan, I suppose, sealed, and that isn't too bad of a repair to do that. 300,000 miles, a lot of miles on any car. I've seen Toyota Matrixes, over 400,000 as well. So, ultimately, you like how the car drives. It just depends on what that estimate is for that repair and what the car's value is to you. But, if it's something where it can be, if this is like the transmission pan gasket, that can be done without taking the transmission out of the vehicle, and it might cost a couple hundred dollars, but I would still think that is worth it. If this has been a good car and it hasn't had a lot of other transmission or any other major kind of problems, if it's something that involves taking the transmission out of the car to have to repair it, that's going to be considerably more expensive, and then you really have to just take a look without looking at the car, knowing the overall condition. If you're looking at spending more than a few hundred dollars on a repair, you probably want to have the whole car looked over a bit just to make sure that there's just not going to be a list of other things that you're potentially looking at having to do that they're going to make you sorry that you invested. 6 months from now, you have another couple major repairs. You're going to regret having invested this money now. So a good thorough inspection and checking it over just to kind of ensure that as much as you can, you determine that the rest of the car is pretty trouble-free and that this is really the only thing you need to do right now.
All right, Nick. Good luck. Thank you. Mike in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello. This is a recall question. I just got a Toyota Prius, and it's a 10,000. And there was one incident where it wouldn't stop through an intersection. And I was told there was a recall on it, and I looked it up. The 2010 was the year they, I guess from what the article said, that they changed the brake system from all electric to a combination of disc and electric. And also there were like 24, 25 incidences of brake failure within the first year of its production. So they had a recall on it. But when I called for, Toyota and the dealer about the recall, they said it quit in January of this year, so I didn't qualify for them fixing the problem. I'm just wondering if it's an engineering issue that was a problem in production or engineering. If that's something where the rebate runs out and you can never recover the cost of repairing that.
That term recall has been used pretty broadly, and technically, a safety recall doesn't expire. It doesn't end. When a manufacturer has an issue, and I'm familiar with that 10 Prius and the brake booster issues that they had with it, if depending on how many cars are involved in it, if they're fairly low threshold, they'll often do a customer support program. So where the original coverage for that component may have been 3 years, 36,000 miles, they'll expand and say, okay, because some of these have failed, but it's a low level, and we're going to expand the coverage to that to 10 years, 150,000 miles, but those do have an end, and those aren't really a recall. It's just a customer support program. The brakes, they didn't really redesign how the brakes work. The brakes were never all electric. They are regenerative, meaning that when you're braking, 95% of your braking in that Prius is going to be the electric motors that drive the wheels when you're accelerating. They change the polarity, and so that when you hit the brake, then they become generators, and the drag from those motors charging is what gives you your braking. And then once you get down to a certain speed, or if you brake hard enough, then the conventional hydraulic brake system, just like any car, takes over. And so they didn't redesign it. They didn't change that. But some of the brake boosters had some manufacturing errors, very low level of them, and so that's what caused the problem, and that's why Toyota went with that support program, because it was a very low percentage of vehicles. And common in many different manufacturers that they'll have these support programs now. Once upon a time they only did a recall if a certain number of cars were involved, or it was I couldn't say this isn't a safety concern, but ultimately it's enough of a safety concern that they launch an actual recall on it. So I'd encourage anyone, if you buy a used vehicle, go to the because the recall notices don't come out from your repair shop. They don't come out from the dealership. They come from the manufacturer. So, you know, whatever kind it is, a Toyota, go to Toyota.com. If it's a Honda, Honda.com, Ford.com, whatever, go to that manufacturer, register yourself as the owner with that VIN number. And then when they have these programs, you will get notified. And you know, because it's a shame. It's a big expense. And it just is not fun to be in that situation where, you know, there's no coverage anymore. And, you know, there was something that could have helped.
Yeah, there you go, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Jerry in Wisconsin Dells will give you a chance now. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning, Larry, and thanks for having this program on a regular basis. It's much appreciated by all. Jim, I have a 2006 Corolla, and getting back to tire issues, I just put two new all-season radials on the front in anticipation of putting them on the back, my other two tires on the back in a couple months when those tires are more worn, and I understand the oversteer and understeer issues with putting new tires only on the front. But I'm having a howling noise on the left front that wasn't there prior, and I've been fooled by tire noise before. And when I'm on a two-lane highway at highway speeds on a right-hand corner, the noise stays the same. It stays the same, the howling going straight ahead. But when I go around a left-hand highway corner, the noise seems to disappear. Any sense to that you can make?
Sure, Jerry. That, you know, that sounds more like a wheel bearing than a tire. The tire that's making noise and a wheel bearing that's making noise, the sound itself is almost exactly the same. You can hardly tell the difference. But a wheel bearing will load. So in other words, when you're going around a corner one way, the noise may actually get a little louder, turn the other way, and it almost goes away or goes completely away. You know, if the car is put on a lift or that wheel's jacked up, you check that wheel. It will almost, if the wheel bearing's worn, it will often feel like the wheel's a little loose, like the lug nuts are loose. Although, you know, the lug nuts may be perfectly tight, but there's a little rocking that you can get. The other thing that if it's a strut suspension, if it's up on a lift and you spin that wheel, you can often feel a vibration from the worn wheel bearing in the coil spring of the suspension. You compare it to the other side, and there wouldn't be any there. So, you know, typically if a tire's making noise, it's going to make the noise turning right, turning left, going forward. But wheel bearings tend to behave like you're describing. So I would have that checked for the free play and vibration and see if you don't actually have a wheel bearing going there.
Yeah, there you go, Jerry. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Ted in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Ted.
Good morning. I got a simple question here. I got a 2019 Honda HR-V. I bought it new at the end of 2019. So it's just coming up
to its first oil change.
Can you hear me?
We lost you there for a minute.
I'm out there for a second.
Okay, good enough. Anyway, just coming up on owning it a year, but it has just over 2,000 miles on it only. How important is that first oil change this early?
It is important. It certainly is early by miles, but usually that low mileage means that you're either driving very short trips or driving the car very infrequently, and what tends to happen is you get condensation in that oil, and that is not good inside the motor. So, you know, all manufacturers have time or mileage recommendations for changing oil, and, you know, particularly that first oil change, although they don't use break-in oil anymore, we don't see as much of that, I definitely would go by that time interval if you've hit that first.
All right, Ted, there you go. Thank you. Samantha in Whitehall. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Anyway, I was just wondering, I have a 2003 Pontiac Grand Am. I got it when it was like 25,000 miles on it in 2014. Now, the two of the doors, all power locks and stuff, but two of the doors, the windows don't go up and down anymore. And they're broken, and the cruise control, when I had my oil change, they looked at it, but it would cost like $250 to get it all rewired to have the cruise control working. And I was just wondering, it's got 160,000 miles on it. What, 160,000, well, anyway, it's got a lot of miles on it, 167,850, there I go. I was just wondering if I should put any more money into it or just look for something something else because I've had this car for a long time and it served me well. That's like
sure.
Question right there.
Well, you know, if those are the only two problems that you've had, and it sounds like they're not going to be cheap to fix, but if they're the only two problems you've had, Grand Am's, you know, a pretty good car. A lot of people that have Grand Am's just love them and you know, keep them as long as they can. I've got a sister-in-law that just loves her Grand Am's and would easily invest in it again. You know, if the car is still everything that you need in a car, that you're not wanting newer features that might be in a somewhat newer car than that, you know, it's probably worth doing the repair. Most people would. I don't think that's, you know, it's a much higher mileage than when you got it in 14. But, you know, if the car's been well cared for and hasn't had other problems, that car, you know, may easily get 250,000, 300,000 miles on it. But once again, you know, when you're in this position and having to make this decision, I would take the car somewhere and have them do an overall checkup on the car and a multi-point inspection. Just look it over to see if there's anything else that might be creeping up in the near future so that if you do decide, okay, well, these are, you know, I wouldn't go farther than this, but I'll fix these windows in the cruise control, and you know, the last thing you want to experience is 6 months from then have some other major repair that could have been predicted or prevented. So that should always be part of the decision when you're at this point where do I buy a new car, do I fix this one? Get an overall evaluation of that car and find out if this is really all you're looking at.
Samantha, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Always great to have him come by. And he's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today, so stay with us. We're going to take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jim on this National Cheese Curd Day, a friend told me. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Always great to have Jim come by. And if you have a vehicle maintenance question, I hope you'll join in. We have lots of callers online, Jim, so I think we'll go straight to the phones. And Jay in Two Rivers. Jay, hello.
Good afternoon, Jim and Larry. I've got two questions. The first one, regarding my 2012 Ford Focus with a 2-liter engine and my 2013 Volkswagen Sportwagon with a 2.5-liter engine, do you know if those engines are interference or non-interference type?
I do not know that off the top of my head. That is typically, though, a Google search question. I couldn't tell you that. The engine designs, you would think that since a non-interference is a safer design, all engines would go to that, but for various reasons, for power and economy gains, some of the engines have to be interference. Although I can't tell you on the two of those, I would Google that. I've been to a couple websites myself where you can put in the year and the model and it'll tell you which that engine is.
There you go, Jay. Thank you for calling. Ralph in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, I had a question regarding a stainless steel exhaust system that I put on my 88 Ford Country Square station wagon a few years ago, and it makes a huge amount of noise in first gear. And I just wonder if you had any idea why that is and how we might be able to straighten it out.
Well, of course, we've got torque in first gear that is going to create vibration. So the hope is that this vibration is something on the outside of this exhaust. And I don't know if you've looked at it already or not, but you may have a heat shield or a clamp or something that can be adjusted or tightened up. If it's if it's coming from inside the exhaust, it's likely a baffle. And ultimately, there really isn't a fix for that. I honestly have seen people do things that I'm not going to say I'm going to recommend. But you know, when you have a loose baffle, I've seen someone take a dead blow hammer and put a dent. You know, just basically listen with like a stethoscope to determine exactly about where the muffler was, and take a dead blow hammer and put a bit of a dent in the muffler. But doing that can cause damage, can cause more problems inside of it. It could stop the rattle. installed, but hopefully the rattle is a clamp or a shield on the outside of the transmission, and you can adjust or tighten it and not really have to worry about the baffles and the internal, because those usually mean you're going to have to replace it to correct it.
Now, there you go, Ralph. Thank you. AJ in Columbus, your turn. Hi, AJ.
Hi. So I have a 2012 Tonic Country, which I'm very frustrated with. So sometimes I get heat, sometimes I don't. Took it to the mechanic, they replaced the radiator, and then he said the heating cord is fine. He did a flush, and he showed me some debris that were in the flush, and then I was getting heat, but now I don't get heat. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. So what can we do next?
Well, have you gone back and he's rechecked it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, because the reason I ask that is that in any cooling system, any antifreeze system, it's a little tricky to get all the air out of the system. And so often after something like this is done and they put it back together and they put an antifreeze in it, there's usually an air bleeding process. But sometimes even then, air can be trapped somewhere in that system. And intermittent heat is often caused by that low coolant level, and air bubbles trapped somewhere. It's not really allowing the heat to flow properly through that heater core part of the system. So it's possible that the debris got into the heater core and has plugged it up, but that tends not to be intermittent, where you have heat sometimes and sometimes you don't. So I have a feeling there's some air in this system, and that ultimately, most often when there's air, it kind of burps out by itself within a few days, and you take the radiator cap off and be able to see that the level's low, fill it up, and that often resolves the problem. Because the first thing, when you get about a half a quart to a quart low on coolant, the engine may still be able to cool itself, but you won't have heat or won't have consistent heat. But if the level is full, that still doesn't necessarily mean there's not an air bubble somewhere else in the system. So, that's the first thing to try is to see if either the level is low, or if it is not, then to do an air bleed on the system. And there's different methods for doing that, but that's really where they should start.
All right. Good luck, AJ. Thank you. Joe in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. I have a 2016 one-ton Dodge Ram pickup. They had a recall on a lot of Dodge trucks due to a drag link adjustment loosening situation. I guess on some trucks, the jam nut was coming loose, and I don't know, I guess you could have a potential hazard of one wheel going in an opposite direction or the other. The thing is, their answer to this was to weld the jam nut. And I took my vehicle over to my local Dodge dealership, and when I saw it, I talked to the mechanic, and they were starting to grind on that jam nut to weld it. I said, well, wait a minute, how am I going to adjust toe in? I'm fairly savvy on working on vehicles. I said, how do I adjust toe in after you guys weld it up? And he said, your guess is as good as mine. And I said, stop. And so I made sure everything was tight. I put Loctite on the situation. I put some indexing marks on that drag link so that I could visually see if it were ever moving, if that adjustment were ever moving. But, I really think that to weld an adjustment situation really is not the answer. And I know a lot of people have done it, but I was really concerned about it. I guess I just want your take on that, or if you're familiar with the situation.
I am, and it is not an ideal repair, because as you mentioned and as you said, it's, once your alignment gets out of adjustment, the only thing you can do is replace that whole drag link, which is not what it was originally designed to do. It was originally designed to be adjustable. And unfortunately, it's not, Dodge is not the only manufacturer that ever has done that. Sometimes I just have to shake my head at the engineers and some of the things that they come up with. And I can't say that there is immune to it either. They've had a similar situation with RAV4s and a rear suspension that's got a toe adjustment that had an issue that they ultimately replaced them with a recall, but then epoxied them so that you couldn't adjust them after that. Those are a compromise that you hate to see. And again, various manufacturers have come out with remedies of that nature over time. It's just not the ideal thing. And, in the case of the RAV4, there's aftermarket adjustable control arms that can be put in. On the Dodge, I'm not sure that someone has come out with an aftermarket remedy for that yet, but that is what I would be looking at. Because, yeah, you don't – I mean, you could weld it, and you're going to be fine with it not coming loose for now, but inevitably it's going to get out of adjustment, and then, you know, then you're looking at a much different situation than just being able to do a normal alignment.
Yeah. There you go, Joe. Thank you so much. Jeff in Galesville, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 2017 Ram, and we took the engine out and all the computers, all that junk, and I put in a Hellfire engine, a muchly modified Hellcat engine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just worried about the driveline. That's still stock. And with 800 horsepower at the wheels, I'm a little nervous I could twist that off.
Well, you're right to be a little nervous about it. You know, of course, if you just drive it real easy, like going, you know, for a Sunday drive, you'll never have that problem. But of course, you know, Jeff, that's not the reason you're putting that Hellfire engine in there. You need to beef up your drivetrain. You know, you put that engine in there because you want to enjoy that power and take it out and drive it, and you certainly run the risk of being able to snap a drive shaft or a yoke or something on that drivetrain. So, yep, that's something that, you know, once you've got the motor and you've got the power, you've got to beef up the rest of the system to be able to take it. That rear differential and everything between your wheels and there needs to be beefed up a bit if you're really going to take it out and take advantage of the performance it can give you.
Thanks, Jeff, for calling. We have Emily next in Madison. Hi, Emily.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 2011 F-250. It's a diesel. And it's an Arizona truck. My husband and I got it last year and drove it back to Maine. And the question I have is, between 48 and 52 miles per hour, it starts getting a little shimmy. And we've tried using, it's a diesel again, so we've tried using different fuels, as in different gas stations. We've changed both fuel filters. You know, everything that we had to do mechanically, we've done. Any thoughts on why it continues?
Well, the first, how do you experience this shimmy? Is it a vibration in the steering wheel or throughout the cab?
It's almost like there's a hesitancy in, you know, as you're going along, it just starts kind of. It's more definitely engine related. It just feels like it's kind of just not smooth at all. Almost like it doesn't want to continue. That, you know, it's kind of, it's hesitating.
I don't know how to describe
it any better.
You may be right. It may be engine, but I, you know, without. Without any warning lights on and nothing indicating any, you know, specific malfunction, I don't know that you're necessarily engine. I mean, it may be ultimately you can get some behaviors like that from a transmission fluid level that's off even just a little bit if it's consistent and it's always at that same point. You know, and I don't know that this is necessarily a shift point, but that is something that can cause some problems. And even if it's not a shift point, a torque converter lockup can be affected. I wish I could tell you more. They're just so limited to go on it. You may be right. It may be engine, but I'm not so sure that that's necessarily where this is at. So, you know, I guess I would check some of these other basic things and make sure that the transmission fluid level is right. Ultimately, otherwise, you know, you could have it scanned to find out if there's any pending codes, anything about, you know, that's about to pop a warning light on and give you more information, some idea what's going on with it. But that one is a bit mysterious. I don't know where else to say to go.
All right, Emily, thanks for calling. Dick in Cudahy, on to you now. Hi, Dick.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two quick questions. One, we just recently bought a RAV4 2020, and when I mentioned to the dealer or the salesman that I usually wax my vehicles at this time of the year every year, He said, do not wax this vehicle until next March or April. Why is that? And secondly, the manual that comes with the RAV4 indicates that if you take it to a car wash, take it to a car wash that has soft brushes. How do you find this out?
Well, I would recommend, in terms of the car wash, we'll start with the last question. I would go to a brushless car wash. Soft brushes are great. They you know, shouldn't scratch the paint, but unfortunately, if the vehicle before you had a lot of grimy, gritty stuff on it that gets on those brushes, the brushes don't scratch your car, but the stuff on the brushes do, and although they have rinse and wash cycles, I would, you know, in that situation, if something's going to touch the car to wash it, I want that something to be in my hand in the way of a sponge that I can look at and be careful what I'm doing. Otherwise, I would recommend a brushless wash. Beyond that, with the paint, they do a pretty good job. Now modern car paint, I don't hear that caution as much as I used to, because modern car paint is set up. It used to be that paint had to kind of set over time. That's not necessarily really true anymore. But they do put a good coating on it when the car is new. What I tend to go by when it comes to waxing the car is, how does the water bead up on the paint? If it's wet and the water has got a nice, even beading all over, then that it's still good to go. When you start to notice that water beading breaking down, and it's not as defined a bead, and it's not as consistent over the whole surface of the paint, then that's the point that you want to wax it.
All right. Good luck, Dick. Thank you. Clay in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Clay.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I got a question. I don't know if you can help me or not. It's my father's car, and he passed away, and it's been sitting in the garage for probably a year and a half, and my mother wanted me to get it running. I went out to try to start it, and the battery was dead. I put a new battery in it, and it still won't turn over. It says it's in security code, like someone's trying to steal it from the battery being dead. There is no more Oldsmobile garages, so I went to a Chevrolet garage. They couldn't answer my question. I went to a Buick garage. They couldn't answer my question. I went on YouTube trying to find something, and I can't find anything. And it's like it's in security. It says security mode, and I don't know how to get it out of that. Any suggestions?
Well, it's a fail-safe mode that the computer in the car gets a signal of a number of different conditions that could potentially damage the motor, and it goes into that mode to prevent it from being able to start and do that damage. So the key here is getting the code to clear, which that is the tricky part, is exactly what you're going to have to do. I mean, there may be, it's so hard to say when the car sat that long. It's possible that rodents got in somewhere and chewed some wires, and you've got some wiring that is touching and is causing a problem. There are some basic relearning procedures that you could look up on Google that have some steps you do with the key in the ignition and turning it on and off at a certain sequence of timing over a period of time, over these little 10-second intervals, and I can't say that I've got it memorized, but that's supposed to reset that. Sometimes just taking the battery terminals off the battery, completely off the battery, and having the positive and negative terminal touching each other completely off and away from the battery for a period of time will help clear out a code like that. But for some reason, during that time that the car has sat, it set a code, which is a kind of a permanent fail-safe code in that computer, not knowing whether if there is damage like the wiring somewhere, it's simply not going to clear until that wiring is repaired. But it's possible that it may have just been set by some kind of a fluke from sitting that long, and either if you look up the procedure for the relearning procedure, you may clear it that way. You may want to try the battery terminal method, but if neither of those work, then there probably is something that's happened to some wiring somewhere in it that's going to have to be fixed before you can resolve it and get it started.
There you go, Clay. Thank you so much. Someone wondered about windshield wipers. What are the best ones for winter driving, and how often should they be replaced?
Well, wipers tend to need replacement about every 6 to 12 months. You know, after a summer of scraping bugs, they're usually pretty toasty, and after winter of scraping ice, they're usually pretty toasty. So going into the bug season, you should replace them. Going into the snow and ice season, you should replace them. And they're, you know, typically most vehicles, the wipers that came on them are fine, although there are different styles of wiper. One style is the traditional one that cars have always had that have quite a support system. It's almost like a little bridge suspension that you see between the top of the wiper and where the rubber mounts. And of course, that is subject to snow and ice getting in there and affecting that ability for the wiper arm to tension the wiper onto the glass, right? The other design is called a beam design, where it really is just very simple looking. You know, you don't have all those alarms and suspension kind of parts between. It doesn't look like, you know, some kind of a bridge side or something on the, you know, on the wiper. And that style, that simplicity prevents the snow and ice from getting on there. So that a beam style wiper tends to be superior for winter driving. You don't necessarily, winter wipers are often sold that they were the old style with all of that suspension and flex stuff in them. They just had a rubber covering over it. And those worked okay. But the beam style is really a superior wiper all the way around. And that is what I would recommend for winter driving.
There we go. Esther in Grays Lake. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you. I have a 2018 Jeep Renegade, and when I first got it new, so it's just a little over, well, 2 years ago, I experienced a stall suddenly. I was driving along, I'd say about 30 miles per hour, and the engine just cut out totally. And it didn't even allow me to drift to the side. I literally stopped in traffic midstream. It hesitated to start again, but it did start, and it seemed fine. So I took it immediately into the dealer to say what's going on, and they said that it looked like I just needed an oil change. I was due for an oil change. And I said, that would make the vehicle stall. And they said, oh, yeah, because it's to protect the engine. I said, well, how about protecting the occupant?
Sure, yeah.
So what do you think there?
Well, 17 and 18 Jeep Renegades had a recall for a faulty fuel pump, and that is what I'm familiar with causing that kind of a stall. So if you were at a Jeep dealer, they should have known that. But again, I'd go to Jeep.com, put your VIN number in there, check for recalls, because that's a known problem.
So there you go. Appreciate your call very much. Another quick one. Where do you stand on warming up the car before driving in cold weather? Is it bad for the car?
It can be, you know, this is one of those marginal things, and not every vehicle is the same this way. A lot of modern engines use direct injection, which means that the fuel injector that's spraying the fuel into the engine is at about 1,500 pounds per square inch, which is really high pressure. When the engine is cold, when you first start it, it's using more fuel, has to have a richer fuel mixture, and inevitably, in the wintertime, in all engines, we end up with a little bit of gas in the oil, which is not good, but it happens, and it's okay if it's under about 5%. In your oil, but the longer the engine takes longer to warm up when you just idle it like that, so it's marginally bad for it. It's not something where doing this once is going to hurt it, you know, and of course it burns more gas too, so if we're all doing that, we're all burning more gas. But if it's me and it's a really cold morning and I don't have seat heaters or something else, I may warm it up a little bit, but truly the car warms up quicker by driving it, and will be better for the car by driving it. But on a really cold morning, it's hard to convince somebody that doesn't have any other way to get warm getting in that cold car that it's not justifiable to warm that thing up so that you're not miserable for that first few miles of driving. But I would minimize how much of you do, because it will warm up quicker and it will be better for the engine in the long run if you warm it up by driving.
Jim, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors, and he will be back on, I'm not sure when he's going to be back, in a couple of months. He'll be back and we'll do this again. Thank you all for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.